This is Arts Alive for this Saturday, January 14th. I'm Brian Lauritsen. On the program today, to become a professional singer, you gotta start early, you have to have a singular focus, and study only at the most prestigious schools. Well, not anymore, at least not here in Los Angeles.
The singing world is changing, and wherever your end goal is, there's no one way, you know? And I love that. I love that about LA because there's so many different opportunities.
Tenor Arnold Livingston Geis knows firsthand the kind of wide-ranging musical career a singer in this city can have, from performing in Beethoven's Missa Solemnis next weekend with the LA Master Chorale to a top-secret movie score project that until recently hid behind a code name. More with Geis later in today's program. Plus, last week we introduced you to the LA-based opera singer Timur, composer Anne LeBaron, and their idea for a project using folk instruments from Timur's home country, Kazakhstan. In a bit, we travel with LeBaron to Kazakhstan for a rehearsal interrupted by a fictional character. Can you guess who? Film critic Kenneth Turan is with us to talk about a documentary full of dance and drama, plus a well-done crowd-pleaser. And on Ask the Dean, Dean Rob Curietta of the USC Thornton School of Music investigates why so many horn concertos are written in the key of E-flat. First, here's Alan Chapman with the week's arts news.
From the Arts Desk today, L.A. lands a new museum and a Silver Lake home is officially historic. Los Angeles beat out San Francisco to become the home of George Lucas's Museum of Narrative Art. It's going to be built in Exposition Park near Lucas's alma mater, USC. And the filmmaker has pledged approximately $1 billion for the project, which covers building costs and an endowment, and his collection of fine and popular art, plus movie memorabilia. Chinese architect Ma Yansong has created a design for a 275,000-square-foot museum that looks like a spaceship right out of Star Wars. Mayor Eric Garcetti told the L.A. Times that L.A., as the creative capital of the world, is a natural place for the museum, and with its addition, Exposition Park is becoming our central park. The mayor said the project will bring the city a new source of tourist dollars, plus tens of thousands of construction jobs and many permanent positions once the museum is up and running. Groundbreaking is planned for sometime this year, and the museum hopes to open its doors in 2021. And a Silver Lake building is now officially a historic landmark. The VDL Research House on Silver Lake Boulevard, designed by Richard Neutra, has been named by the U.S. Department of the Interior as one of 24 new National Historic Landmarks. The Austrian-born Neutra built the mid-century modern masterpiece in 1932. He and his family lived there until his death in 1970. Now it's owned by the nonprofit Cal Poly Pomona Foundation, and they've undertaken several restoration projects over the last 10 years. In a statement, the Department of the Interior said the house is the only property where one can see the progression of the architect's style over a period of years and is among the key properties to understanding the national significance of Richard Neutra. That's the arts news for Saturday, January 14th. On this date in 1900, Puccini's opera Tosca was premiered in Rome. For Arts Alive, I'm Alan Chapman.
This is Arts Alive on Classical KUSC. I'm Brian Lauritsen. Last week, on our first of four features about LA artists working in Kazakhstan, opera singer Timur and CalArts professor and internationally renowned composer Anne LeBaron decided to collaborate on a project in Timur's home country. Today, we travel with Anne as she flies across the globe to the city of Almaty to see the famous Steppes of Eurasia and hear little-known Kazakh instruments. Contributing reporter Adriana Cargill brings us the story, and here's LeBaron.
Well, my feeling in going to Kazakhstan, I was absolutely excited to experience it and to investigate and learn about the instruments and undertake the project. Until I found out that Timur couldn't go with me.
Anne was worried because she didn't speak Russian or Kazakh. English isn't commonly spoken in that part of the world, but she decided to go anyway.
I had placed myself on a mission to share with the world the artistic history of this country that we don't seem to know about so much in the West.
Plus, she was excited by the challenge. She'd done a lot of research, and Timur had made arrangements for her. But she wasn't prepared for what happened when she got there.
The idea for going, the reason, the entire reason for me to go to Almaty was to conduct a workshop with the musicians of the folk orchestra so that I could learn about the instruments and know how to write for them, how to compose music for them.
When she showed up at the concert hall, an entire orchestra of musicians was waiting for her. They were decked out in sky blue embroidered silk robes, and the women wore hats with large white plumes of feathers shooting out of the top.
And about 5 minutes into this demonstration, where I felt like a special person sitting alone in this huge concert hall with this entire orchestra performing for me, I hear a ruckus up toward the back of the auditorium. And then I saw these two men were stomping down the aisle, and they came up to me and they made the sign where, you know, the throat slit sign, like, stop that right now.
She turned off her recorder. Her translator and manager went out into the lobby, and she heard a lot of loud arguing. She and the orchestra just waited. When they finally came back in, the entire rehearsal was shut down.
I felt like my balloon had been popped, you know, because there goes my chance with the orchestra. And it was so devastating. And we didn't know what had happened. And I said, I can't do this project. I was very upset. I said, I have to have access to the musicians. There's no way. This is why I flew all the way here, halfway around the world. What's going on?
Turns out, there was a rumor going around that Anne was there filming the sequel to Borat. Yeah, you remember. The Sacha Cohen film?
Yak shamash. My name is Borat. I journalist for Kazakhstan. My government sent me to USA to make a movie film.
The Kazakh government was extremely upset at America for making that film. And since Anne was American, well, she was suspect. At any rate, Anne was able to salvage the situation and work with some of the musicians in a little classroom the next day. Kazakhstan is an immense country. It's the ninth largest in the world. It's got snow-covered mountain ranges and the world-famous steppes of Eurasia. These steppes, think vast, sweeping prairie land, have been the home of nomads for thousands of years. And most of Kazakhstan's indigenous instruments were created by these wanderers. They needed to be light, transportable, and easy to make. We sit around the table at her apartment in downtown LA. She shows me her favorite Kazakh instruments and a book she got on one of her trips there. She's pointing to a picture of a woman seated playing something that looks like a beautifully decorated wooden box, only it has strings across it.
This is what I was looking for. This is the jetagan. And see, these are actual vertebrae that are functioning as pegs to hold the strings. On one side of the peg you pluck, and on one side of the peg, you bend the string. This is my favorite. This is absolutely an otherworldly instrument. It's called kilkobis. And it's a string instrument that is strung with horsehair strings, and it's bowed with a bow, with horsehair. So you can see here is a very ancient one. It's held upright. It's about the size of a viola. And the sound of it is like a cross between a human voice and an organ. It's the most haunting sound of all. The dombra is the most famous. And the dombra is like a guitar. It's like a two-string instrument, such a simple instrument. Here we go. It has a pear shape to the body, and then it's just two strings and a very long neck. What the players can get from this instrument, it's just, it makes your heart race.
Dobra playing wasn't the only thing that got her excited. Anne visited the snow-capped Altai Mountains, where Russia, China, Mongolia, and Kazakhstan meet. She also drank fermented camel's milk and choked down horse meat. She arrived back in the States full of ideas. From this, the Silent Steppe Cantata was born, an opera inspired by the history of Kazakhstan. Anne would compose it and score it. Timur would be the tenor soloist, and there'd be a women's choir, a narrator, and an orchestra of indigenous Kazakh folk instruments.
When I first started hearing about it, it was much like other projects I've heard with Timur, which is, you know, tantalizing and sometimes a little mystifying.
That's Chad Smith, currently the LA Phil's chief operating officer, talking about Timur, the LA-based Kazakh opera singer. Timur was the one who introduced composer Anne LeBaron to Kazakh folk music. While Anne was composing the cantata, Chad was the VP of artistic planning for the Phil. Timur knew Chad always had an ear out for interesting projects. So in their regular coffee dates, he kept him updated on how the project was coming together during the 3 years he and Anne traveled back and forth to Kazakhstan. For its premiere on December 10th, 2011, he invited Chad to see it and introduce it. To do that, he'd have to travel to Astana, the capital of Kazakhstan.
I have to tell you, when I first arrived, I had very little sense of what was coming. And I had my expectations about what the classical music scene would be like in Astana it was just a blank. I had no idea what to expect.
He certainly was in for an unexpected surprise. Find out what Chad discovers in Kazakhstan and hear the Silent Steppe Cantata. Next week's Arts Alive. The story is brought to us by contributing reporter Adriana Cargill. And you can see photos of some of the instruments LeBaron described and hear part one of this series on the Arts Alive blog, which you can find at kusc.org. You're listening to Arts Alive. I'm your host, Brian Lauritsen, and still to come on today's program, how one singer is approaching a work critics said was impossible. No human lungs can endure the strain imposed by it. But first, LA Times and Arts Alive film critic Kenneth Turan joins KUSC's Gail Eichenthal to talk about a pair of new movies.
Let's start with Reset, which is an interesting title for a documentary about Benjamin Millepied, former director of the Paris Opera Ballet, who resigned since this film was made.
Yes, this is a really fascinating film. I mean, the film doesn't tell you that he's resigned till the very end, though obviously most people who will see it will know this going in. The film is very beautiful. I think the key thing you want to say about it is that the directors and cinematographers really have a wonderful eye, and it's just a real pleasure to watch this film. You know, it reminded me several years ago, Frederick Wiseman did a similar documentary on the Paris Opera Ballet called La Danse, which was equally beautiful. There's something about this company that calls out the beauty in filmmakers. But again, as you say, this has Benjamin Millepied as a centerpiece. And he left after 2 years. And he doesn't, obviously, while this film is being made, he doesn't know that he's leaving. But you see some of the issues that arise. You see some of the reasons, you know, as came out later, once he left, he told people why he left, and having to deal with bureaucracy, having to deal with the militaristic, very rigid system in the Paris Opera Ballet, he could deal with it, but you can see that what he really loves is choreography. He wants to work with dancers, and the time that he had to take away from that to deal with all the kind of craziness of a bureaucracy and a very ancient school, he just said, I don't want to do this with my life.
Well, it's a 300-year-old company, and there are a lot of old-fashioned conventions that are still being followed. He's also spoken openly about the fact that it's pretty much white, a white company, and he was working toward some sort of racial diversity. But I guess Parisian's loss is L.A.'s gain, because he's coming back here to run his own small modern dance company. So the film really works as a film.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, I thought it was quite interesting. I mean, I'm actually surprised they're releasing it in January, which is usually kind of a dumping ground for films. This is quite a good documentary. And if you care about ballet, obviously you just have to see this. There's no question about that. One of the key things that you find out in the film, he says it himself, Benjamin Lupier says it himself, and one of his friends says it, he comes to dance through pleasure. Dance is a real pleasure for him. And you can see that what happens is that the kind of the other forces, the anti-pleasure forces in the Paris Opera Ballet finally got to be too much for him. It just wasn't as much fun. Dance for him, you know, even though he was dancing for 20 years and it's an arduous thing, but it was always fun. And it got to be less fun and he couldn't deal with it.
A film that came out at the end of the year that we haven't gotten a chance to talk about is Hidden Figures, which deals with a true story about African-American women at NASA.
Yes, well, you know, before computer referred to a machine, computer was a word used to refer to people who did computation, people who did really the complicated math that was necessary, you know, to put people into space when the space program began. And among the human computers was a group of African-American women working in segregated Virginia. And this is their true story. And, you know, this film is a crowd pleaser. This is a classic kind of a crowd pleaser. But the great thing about it is that it's a well-done crowd pleaser. I mean, if you hate crowd pleasers, if you just want something sour, you're not going to be happy. But so many, you know, Hollywood has kind of lost the gift for making really effective crowd pleasers. And this is enormously effective. The weekend it opened, it had, you know, nationwide, I think last week, it had a very strong opening. People are embracing this film, and I think this is a film that people are going to, you can feel good about feeling good after you see this film.
Theodore Melfi is the director. He put together a very strong cast, didn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, yeah. Taraji P. Henson plays the key woman in the group. The three women, she's the brain. Octavia Spencer plays the organized woman. And Janelle Monáe, who's also in Moonlight, is a woman who really wants to better herself. She wants to be an engineer. There have never been black female engineers in NASA, and she wanted to be the first one. And it's just very well acted. It's just, and also, you know, I want to put in a word for Kevin Costner, who plays everyone's boss, who's an amalgam. These three women are based on real people. Kevin Costner is an amalgam of several NASA figures, but he's very effective. He kind of grounds the film in a way that is it wouldn't be as good without him.
L.A. Times and Arts Alive film critic Kenneth Turan speaking with Gail Eichenthal about Hidden Figures, out now in wide release, and that documentary about Benjamin Millepied and the Paris Ballet. It's called Reset, and you can see it at the Lemley's Theater on Wilshire in Beverly Hills. Listening to Arts Alive here on Classical KUSC. I'm Brian Lauritsen. Hope you'll join us next week when we travel once again to Kazakhstan and talk to a pop singer about crossing into classical. You can listen to archived episodes of Arts Alive anytime with the Arts Alive podcast. Find it at kusc.org. Coming up, we ask the dean. But first, in 2012, Arnold Livingston Geist made his professional operatic debut in Los Angeles. He was in the chorus of The Flying Dutchman at LA Opera. 3 years later, he was performing in front of a much different kind of audience with the classiest boy band there is. KUSC's Kelsey McConnell has more.
When Geist and three of his friends from college stepped onto the stage at America's Got Talent, no one knew what to expect.
What is your name?
We are Vox.
How long has Vox existed?
A little less than a month.
Less than a month. All right, well, dazzle us with your Voxes.
The first voice the judges heard was Geis.
Vincerò.
got a standing ovation. It was really, really awesome.
One of the judges called you the classiest boy band there is.
Yeah, it was Howie Mandel, I think, he said that. We were ecstatic. We didn't even know what to think at the time. You know, right after the performance, they took us out on Hollywood Boulevard right outside the theater, and there were cameras following us, and, you know, there were also people coming up with their camera phones filming us. It was just crazy. It was like the ultimate, you know, Hollywood experience. We couldn't have asked for more.
Vox still performs. Their website is voxsings.com. Geis also sings for the big screen as a session musician for movie soundtracks, where you just never know what you're going to be asked to do.
Those sessions can be stressful if you're not confident in your sight reading skills, but mostly they're just really cool. The movie's playing behind you while you're singing. You know, you're actually part of the movie making process, and that's what I love most about those gigs. You know, I never in a million years dreamed that I'd be in the booth singing to one of my favorite movies of all time, which was just recently Star Wars Rogue One, and that was amazing. It was very hush-hush. We had to sign a million non-disclosure agreements, and we didn't actually get to learn what scenes we were singing for. All we got was the director came in, and he said, "You're singing for the most important scenes in the movie," and that's all we can tell you.
Last season, Guy sang his first solo with LA Opera during their production of Pagliacci, which was conducted by none other than Placido Domingo.
What was it like to be a tenor singing for one of the great tenors?
I'll never forget the moment that I first sang for Domingo. It was in an orchestra dress rehearsal. It was a quick little 1-2-page solo line, and I was like a disgruntled villager or something. It was a flyby solo, but I'll never forget. I'm actually standing here on LA Opera, on the Dorothy Chandler stage, singing for my hero, you know. It's just a moment I'll never forget.
Next weekend, Geis is a soloist with the LA Master Chorale for Beethoven's Missa Solemnis. Geis is in his fourth season with the chorale, and in next week's concert, he'll be the only soloist from the ranks of the chorale itself.
So usually you're one voice in many. Are you nervous mm-hmm. about being a soloist?
Well, I think Pavarotti said, if you don't get nervous before you sing, you're not alive, and if you say you're not nervous, you're a liar. And I think that's really true. I'm more excited right now. I'm sure the nerves will get to me by the time next weekend rolls around.
So I was reading about the piece, and I came across all these great descriptions of it. An avalanche released by a speck of dust. The work is impossible. No human lungs can endure the strain imposed by it. I read another critic who was saying there's something peculiar about it. And part of that may be that it's a mass, but we don't really know how religious Beethoven was or if he was religious. I read that it took him a very long time to write, and it apparently meant a lot to him. How does the work strike you, or how are you thinking about it?
Yeah, I mean, I remember doing the work with the Phil a couple years ago when Michael Tilson Thomas conducted the chorale. And I just remember the work being so different from anything that I'd done before. I understand he wrote it when he was completely deaf. And when you sing through it, you can really tell that he wrote this very analytically and academically. The vocal lines are kind of like instrumental lines rather than voice lines. And I think that's why it makes it so different and interesting. It doesn't seem bombastic or in your face. It's, I think, just true. Sometimes oratorios can get showy in the vocal lines, but this is just long lines of lush, beautiful harmony, and it's an honor to sing.
It seems like there isn't really the same kind of choral tradition in America as in other countries, so LA is really lucky to have the Master Chorale and Grant Gershon. In your opinion, what does Grant bring to the Master Chorale?
Grant is just, I think he's kind of a pioneer. I mean, I love working with him. His musicianship and the way he handles the chorale, the singers that he attracts to the chorale, it's just amazing what he's doing with it. And it could easily just stay stagnant and, you know, just be the Los Angeles Master Chorale. But I think he's taking it to the next level by innovating, putting up new works and works that aren't often performed, and utilizing the talent that he has. He has so much talent, and LA is just full of all these talented artists with something to say.
Geis says he loves having such a diversity of performance opportunities. From film to opera to the chorale, he loves it all. And he loves the feeling that singing with other people gives him, a feeling he was lucky to discover as a teenager.
Yeah, it kind of almost saved my life in a way, just gave me something to work towards, to live for, to love. My mother actually passed away just before high school, and she just had the most amazing soprano voice. And music just was a refuge, you know, a place to go to where you could express and not feel, you know, judged or outcast for that. You just make these connections with people that, you know, last. And now it's proven scientifically. There's, you know, you can actually see the health benefits from being in a part of a choir. It's amazing, and I wouldn't trade it for anything.
Tenor Arnold Livingston Geis. The LA Master Chorale member is a soloist in the upcoming performances of Beethoven's Missa Solemnis. Those take place next Saturday at 2 p.m. and Sunday evening at 7, both at Walt Disney Concert Hall. And for tickets and more information, visit lamc.org. And KUSC's Kelsey McConnell spoke with Geis. And now here once again is Gail Eichenthal with a question about key signatures for Dean Rob Cudietta of the USC Thornton School of Music.
Dean Rob, our question today comes from Albert, who has the impression that horn concertos written in the 18th and early 19th centuries were mostly written in a single key, and that is the key of E flat. Is that true? And if so, why?
Well, first of all, I think this just shows how sophisticated KUSC listeners are. I wonder how he knows they're in E-flat. Does he have perfect pitch or what? But I went to Christy Morrell, who is our horn teacher at the Thornton School, and talked with her about that. And you know what? Albert's totally correct, is that when you go back, most of the horn concerti from that era are written in the key of E-flat. And there's really, really a practical reason for that. At that time, the horns were valveless. So they would change keys by putting crooks in out. And a crook is an extension. It's a part of the tubing that you can move around. And there is one for every key, and or for most keys. And then the player would actually change the pitch by using their hand on the bell to actually get the pitch. As it turns out, the E-flat crook was just one of the most favorite. It really sounded the best. It was easiest to manipulate. So it was the favored key for the horn. And until we got into valved horns, which was much later. So he's absolutely, absolutely right that they are written there, and there's a very practical reason. You know, a side reason is many composers also think of E-flat as a very heroic kind of key, but I think that's secondary in this case.
Beethoven Eroica, sure. Emperor Concerto, and three of Mozart's horn concertos, Haydn's famous and only famous trumpet concerto, E-flat. So definitely Albert is onto something.
He definitely is.
Thanks, Dean Rob.
Thank you.
Do you have a question about music for Dean Rob Cudietta and his team of experts? What about a question about the world of dance? Cudietta is also the dean of the Gloria Kaufman School of Dance at USC. Music or dance, you can email your questions to askthedean@kusc.org. Once again, that's askthedean@kusc.org. And that wraps up this edition of Arts Alive for this Saturday, the 14th of January. I hope you'll join us next week when we continue our exploration of the musical landscape of Kazakhstan. And we talk to singer Storm Large about seven deadly sins. That's next Saturday morning at 8 on Arts Alive. The technical director is Mark Hatwan. Kelsey McConnell is the executive producer. We had help this week from contributing reporter Adriana Cargill and from KUSC's Alan Chapman and Gail Eichenthal. Thanks also to Sheila Tepper. I'm Brian Lauritsen. Have a great weekend.